From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, news that the U.S. plans to expand its military force in Iraq to the highest level of the war, 150,000 troops. Back home, recruiters are working hard to keep a fresh supply of troops coming. With November one of the bloodiest for U.S. forces since the Iraq conflict began, the job of a citizen soldier appears more hazardous than ever, and recruitment strategies and targeting are raising issues of fairness. Tonight on Point, who's fighting the war and how America recruits its troops. But first, we begin tonight with the latest on military recruiting on college campuses. The Third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday struck down a federal law permitting the Defense Department to deny funds to colleges and universities that barred military recruiters from their campuses. Some schools are already preparing to bar the door to recruiters. For today's developments and ramifications of the ruling, we go to Jeff Salingo, senior editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education in Washington. Jeff, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
So here we had a group of law schools that said, we don't want to be forced to permit recruiters on the campus. What was their argument, and how did the court come down, Jeff?
Their argument has been, and it has been for about a decade, that the military's don't ask, don't tell policy basically flies in the face of their anti-discrimination policies.
That is, don't ask, don't tell on gays in the military.
Right. And basically the law schools have said that this flies in the face of their own anti-discrimination policies, and as a result, they didn't want these recruiters on campus. And so they sued the government over this, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia on Monday ruled 2-1. That these colleges cannot be penalized with the loss of federal funds for denying access for these recruiters.
So this wasn't a case where they said we simply don't want military recruiters on our campuses. Rather, they said we don't agree with an Army policy, and therefore we want the freedom to be able to boycott these recruiters.
Exactly. I mean, you know, some law schools do allow these recruiters on campus. Most have, actually, since the Solomon Amendment was put in place about a decade ago. And basically that amendment said that if colleges did not allow the recruiters on campus, they were at risk of losing federal funds for research. And at some colleges and universities, especially in the Ivy League, that can mean a couple $100 million.
So with billions of dollars at stake nationally, nobody wanted to defy the government on that. In fact, we read that some of the colleges who were party to this suit did not want to be named in the suit.
Exactly. They were afraid of retribution by the government, and so only a few of the colleges that were part of the lawsuit actually put their name to it.
Which law schools do we know were part of the suit?
New York University was part of it, along with a couple of others. But again, most of them were not named.
I think George Washington,
yes.
Maybe Georgetown, Stanford, Harvard, and maybe more.
But there were about 25 in total, but most of them were not named in this lawsuit.
So now they have the freedom to bar recruiters again. Are they beginning to do it?
Harvard announced yesterday that they will. And in fact, even though Harvard is in the First Circuit, and so actually they're not technically under this ruling only applies to a couple of states in the Third Circuit, but Harvard announced yesterday that they are going to go back to their original policy, which is barring recruiters from campus. Most other law schools that I actually talked to today said that they were going to continue to study the ruling. There's also an expectation that the Justice Department is going to appeal this ruling to the entire Third Circuit Court or to the Supreme Court, and so most law schools are just waiting to see what happens in that appeal process.
So a ruling on First Amendment grounds and at least one school already responding. Jeff, what's the bigger picture? We know that most recruitment is focused on high schoolers or those just out of high school. Is recruiting on college campuses generally an issue these days, or is it just come on in?
It really isn't. And the reason why you're seeing law schools as a big part of this, of the Solomon Amendment, is that because the military goes to law schools to recruit people for the JAG Corps. These are the lawyers that represent the military and military families and other people in the military. And so as a result, they need lawyers for the JAG Corps. And that's why this is a big issue on law school campuses. You know, the military really doesn't go to college campuses to recruit people. I mean, they're recruiting people out of high school. People who go to college really don't want to go to the military. And if they do, they're just going to go on their own. They don't really need to be recruited. So that's why this has become a big issue at law schools. And especially now, you know, with all the legal troubles in the military right now, now the military needs a lot of people who are lawyers and needs people in the JAG Corps, and that's why they're really starting to push this issue.
A big demand right across the board in the federal government with the Solomon Amendment in 1995 and with President Bush's No Child Left Behind Act. Both of those were big crowbars, essentially forcing all kinds of schools to let the recruiters in.
That's true. I mean, you know, this law was originally put in place during the Clinton administration, and they really didn't pursue colleges on this matter. And in fact, just a couple of months ago, Congress enlarged the number of funds that are at risk if colleges defy the Solomon Amendment to really try to push colleges even harder to make sure that they followed this law.
But tonight, the first sound of doors closing in some of these elite law schools to military recruiters. Jeff Salingo, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Jeff Salingo is senior editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education. He spoke with me from Washington. U.S. military hospitals are filled to capacity tonight with casualties from Fallujah and beyond, a result of last month's big push and some of the deadliest fighting since the Iraq War began. Now, word that the number of U.S. troops in Iraq will swell to a record 150,000 before planned national elections next month. In this tense climate, where are new recruits coming from? Who's standing up to serve? Often, they're straight out of high school, but not all teens and not all high schools are targeted equally. This hour on Point, we're talking about who's fighting the war and how America recruits its troops. Do you know who's fighting America's battles today? Is it kids from your family, your town, your neighborhood, or not? And in a democracy, should the burden of war be shared by a real cross-section of society or by those who need the job? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me right now from Washington is Charlie Savage. He's Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. This week, he wrote an article about how military recruiters strategically target high schools and high schoolers. Charlie Savage, thanks for being with us.
Good evening.
It was a terrific piece of reporting. We enjoyed it enormously. I learned a lot from it. I wish you'd paint a picture of the two high schools that were at the center of your reporting, Charlie Savage, the difference between them and the difference in recruiting at the two.
Certainly. Well, I was interested in getting a tops-to-bottom, nuts-to-bolts look at how recruiting gets done. And to start with that, I went out into various high schools in the area around here. And I found one, which was in a lower-middle-class community where there wasn't a lot of economic opportunity, in which the military was everywhere in this school, just absolutely saturated it.
This is McDonough High in Pomfret, Maryland.
That's right. But it's like there are many high schools like this across the country. These are high schools where the military comes in and recruits constantly. They chaperone dances. They administer tests. They are there at track meets. There's a big junior ROTC program where they have a retired sergeant in uniform who gives kids class credits for learning how to drill. The school is an absolute goldmine of recruits for the military, and there's a chicken and the egg issue of why that is, because they are just there every time you turn around the corner.
And what was your analysis of why McDonough High is such an attractive target for recruiters?
Well, it's a place where their own computer models show that they've gotten a lot of recruits in the past, and so they tend to concentrate their resources where they've had success in the past. At some point, though, the question is, to what extent does that become a self-fulfilling prophecy? Because if you go to other public schools but in slightly more affluent areas, or just schools where the principal of the school may not be particularly friendly towards the military, may say, stay out of here except for the minimum that I have to let you in under the federal law, then in those schools what you see is twice a year, each service gets to come in. There's a few pamphlets in the guidance office, but otherwise it's all about college. College visits here, college visits there. Come, the posters, the pennants, that's the message, the marketing culture that those kids are saturated in.
So you went from working class McDonough High School, 30 or 40 miles to McLean High in Virginia. And as I read it, students at McDonough High, six times more likely than those at affluent McLean to join the military, to be recruited.
That's true. Well, of course, the numbers fluctuate from year to year, but the largest gap would be about six times. And of course, affluent kids are going to be more likely to go to college as a group than working class kids. But the question is, at some point, if you put all this marketing pressure, this $2.6 billion a year hard sell effort in school A and almost none of it in school B, are you also going to induce kids who otherwise would have made other choices to also join up? And that's what I was interested in.
Charlie, give us a sense of how the recruitment works. It seemed highly sophisticated, very refined the way you describe it. The Army comes in, this is Army in this case, I guess, with what they call the blueprint. Give us a sense of strategically and tactically how they go about targeting and then reeling in the recruits they need.
Well, it's actually quite impressive just from a sales perspective. The recruiting techniques have been developed over time and with a great deal of sophistication. The blueprint you referred to is a computer program they use, which tracks each individual student, the contacts they've had with them each time, or their parents or teachers, what the student has said. If the student is eligible for recruitment, they'll send a call at least six times over the course of a couple years to try to capture that student as maybe they lose a job or drop out of college if they've decided to say no the first couple times. In addition, they bring in census data and past recruitment data from all the other services and a great deal of information to help them find those zip codes in those high schools that they think are going to be most receptive to their message. When they find a school in those zip code that they think is going to be receptive, then they bring in a whole series of techniques. They have a manual that I got a hold of that tells recruiters how to sort of interject themselves into high school, to become essential to those high schools.
Make themselves indispensable by helping out with high school activities.
They help out with high school activities. The manual tells them how to, like, bring coffee and donuts to secretaries so that they sort of ease the way into the door. They're supposed to seek out popular kids, popular coaches, popular teachers. They call these people centers of influence. And then work hard to befriend them and get them on their side. Not necessarily so in the case of the captain of the football team that person may join up himself, but because he will influence other people in his peer group to think this is a good idea.
They talk about the Army as a product which can be sold, quoting there, and they've got different kind of lures they can hold out. And finally, there's just the sense that young men can be challenged to do this if you've got them just right. I don't know if you have the manual in front of you there, Charlie, but you quote a bit about what they call the challenge close. Do you have that in front of you?
I do, actually. This is one of many closing the deal techniques that the manual lays forth. It sort of reveals the sort of psychological preparation recruiters have going in. So I can quote this one. It says, "The challenge closing method works best with younger men. You must be careful how you use this one. You must be on friendly terms with your prospect or it may backfire. It works like this. When you find difficulty in closing, particularly when your prospect's interests seem to be waning, challenge his ego by suggesting that basic training may be too difficult for him and he might not be able to pass it. Then, if he accepts your challenge, you will be a giant step closer to getting him to enlist."
And boom, if it works, they've got one more recruit. You also talked with psychologists about the psychology of teenage targets. They're vulnerable to the kind of group mentality here.
It's true. I mean, now, of course, there's some kids for whom the military is a good fit. They would be eager if no one ever contacted them to sign up.
These Absolutely.
Are the kids that they'll go onto the websites and say, send me information, and that's fine. But what gets interesting is the kid who may not be that perfect fit, but in an environment like this starts to become susceptible to a message that otherwise he would not embrace. Now, the one psychologist that I talked to, that I quote in the story at least, has written a book about the impact of media on the adolescent brain, and he talks about how studies have shown that teenage brains are just physically not yet fully developed, such that they are less independent of group opinion, less likely to consider long-term consequences than adults, even in their early 20s. So when you have centers of influence and marketing culture and multimedia events that constantly surrounds a kid who is of that nature, that kid is going to slide towards accepting that as a choice in a more susceptible way.
Charlie, briefly, was McDonough High School proud to get all this attention from the military?
McDonough High School is very military receptive. It's in an area that's near military bases. There's a lot of parents that are military. The guidance counselor I talked to, his own son, had just spent 4 years in the Air Force. That's definitely part of this school's identity. So if you happen to live in the zip code that goes to that school, that's the sort of environment in which you're going to be saturated.
But meanwhile, over the river and through the woods at Affluent McLean, very, very different picture. We'll come back and talk about that. Charlie Savage with the Boston Globe, please stick with us. We're talking tonight about who's fighting the war and how America recruits its troops. Do you know who's fighting the country's battles today? Is it kids from your family, your town? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about who's fighting the war and how America recruits its troops. You can join the conversation. How do you see being recruited into the U.S. military? Do you see it as an opportunity or something else? And is it just common sense to target young Americans of modest income and modest prospects? Or is it wrong? Is it unfair? When a democracy goes to war, should its citizen soldiers be drawn from a real cross-section of the population? Or is that just unrealistic? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with Charlie Savage, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe, who's been reporting on recruiting in a couple of high schools in the greater Washington area. I'm joined now in the studio by Cindy Williams. She's principal research scientist at the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's editor of Filling the Ranks, Transforming the U.S. Military System. Cindy Williams, welcome. Wonderful to have you back with us.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
And joining us tonight from Kansas City, Missouri, is Todd Zwolinski. He is a captain and company commander for recruiting in Greater Kansas City. Todd Zwolinski, Captain Zwolinski, very good to have you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Captain Zwolinski, first to you. I wish you'd give us a sense of how the recruiting's going these days. It's been a tough patch in Iraq. Is that making it harder, or are you finding that young American people, teenagers, are standing up and saying they want to go because of that?
Total volume-wise, it actually hasn't affected us that much. The largest influencer on recruiting is the economy. Back during the tech bubble, it was very difficult to assess people into the military just because there were a lot of opportunities outside the military. Now with the war, it's changed the demographic a little bit of who's going in. It's smarter, more rural kids as opposed to the urban, basically socio-disadvantaged individuals.
And why rural teenagers, Captain Zwolinski? How do you interpret that?
Generally, the reasons that you would go in during a wartime situation would be more service to nation, patriotism, and the rural areas have that in greater abundance than the urban areas do. The propensity has actually dropped significantly in the urban area, whereas it's picked up in the rural.
And when you and the recruiters who work with and under you set out to fill your quotas and make your bonuses and all the rest, to make the system work, how do you target the schools which are going to be most likely to yield recruits for you? Do you look at you said economics is the number one kind of influencer here. Do you look at an income map of the counties you deal with, or how do you begin?
We use a lot of different things. There's a huge focus on high school students to go to college. The media has basically shaped their view, and there's a lot of kids that go to school that will not succeed. In fact, 68% of college students drop out and don't get their degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that the Army has done, because the Army is the largest recruiting force, is they tend to direct us to go more for the colleges as opposed to the high schools. Within the colleges, we basically see a lot of the college dropouts, kids that weren't ready to go to school, and those are the ones that we're recruiting. That's our largest core. We do recruit in the schools, the high schools, and the important part about the high schools, it's kind of funny. Earlier in the show, we were talking about different schools. Those schools in the Midwest, the working-class schools, generally do not produce as well. It's basically the rural schools and then the very ritzy suburban schools that are our primary producers.
No kidding. And who do you recruit for, or what's the difference in the way you recruit with the rural schools and what you describe as the ritzy suburban schools?
The rural schools, one thing with the recruiters, they've got to be very trustworthy and they've got to be very solid and everything's got to be on paper, because the rural people generally move slower, make slower decisions. However, they're more solid when they do make a decision. In a suburban school, It's basically adventure and travel are the big motivators for kids to go in. We've also seen a significant increase in the amount of kids that are in the top socioeconomic bracket coming in with political gains in mind later on down the road. I don't know if that was influenced by this past election or during the Clinton years of there being a lack of military service.
Right. So they want to. They're imagining being able to say one day, "I stood up and fought for the country in Iraq."
Exactly. Exactly. It's really interesting. I've been in recruiting now for 2 years and 2 months, and the shift since the war started has increased. We've actually put more people in this year than we did last year on the active side. However, there's a lot more rural, a lot more females. In fact, almost 50% of my company's production is females.
Female, no kidding. Captain Zielinski, stand by. I want to get Cindy Williams in here. Cindy, you've been watching all these trends and where things are headed for a good while now. And you hear, I'm hearing two different things tonight. Charlie Savage went out around the Washington area, saw a working-class high school, an affluent high school, and found a big difference in the recruitment levels. Captain Zielinski in Kansas City area is saying, well, you know, some of those Tony suburban schools are pretty good targets for us. Overall, what's the pattern of who's recruited into the U.S. military today socioeconomically?
Yeah, I think you're really hearing two sides to the same story. You know, we've had an all-volunteer force since 1973, and the engine of the all-volunteer force, the thing that really makes it work, is that many people see the opportunities that the military offers as outweighing some of the disadvantages. And some of them see the opportunities as being some of the non-monetary or non-economic benefits that the captain mentioned, things like being proud of the institution that you are a part of, having a chance to express your patriotism, having an opportunity for adventure. Others see the economic opportunities as being huge for them, especially if they have relatively restricted opportunities to advance economically from where they begin life. And so you see that people see both the pay and the benefits while they're in the military as attractive if they're coming from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. But they also see the opportunities for gaining skills in the military that they can then use outside the military after they leave.
But when you look nationally at the numbers, where does the bulk of recruitment come from? What level of society, economically speaking?
Yeah, the bulk of the recruitment it typically comes from the middle class. And the lower end of the middle class, but all the way up to the upper middle class. And as you pointed out initially, hasn't been that much recruiting from elites. But I think the point that the captain made, that we may see a big turnaround after this past election that so much emphasized the military histories of the two candidates, that elites may say, if I ever want to serve in public office, I have to think about this. And that may be a reward that entices them to serve more than they have been in recent years.
This in spite of the fact that John Kerry's Vietnam service got slammed all over the place and ended up being a kind of a mixed thing for him.
I think the very fact that it was a major item of discussion, a major item of political debate, means that people will not imagine that they can walk away from the opportunity to serve in the military and then serve in high position in public life.
Charlie Savage, you've been out talking with people in these high schools. We're hearing a bit of a different story from the Kansas City area tonight, and Cindy Williams saying, well, the recruiting is middle class, lower middle class, but right across the middle class. There's a kind of theme or view going around Washington in some quarters that there's an element of unfairness in who's being targeted, who's being recruited. How strongly are you hearing that?
Well, you hear it strongest probably from Representative Charlie Rangel, who's a New York Democrat. He has been blasting the recruiting system ever since the start of the war, I guess the start of the Afghanistan war, for, as you have been summing up, sort of unfairly allowing society to rest the collective burden of national defense only on the shoulders of those kids who need the money, as he would put it.
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes the trend of the rural recruit as well. But also running through his argument is a strong sense of racial grievance. He thinks that black students, especially, and minorities are being asked to carry a heavier burden here. I'm not sure that that's correct, having looked at the data. It seems to me that class more than race is the overriding feature here. And in fact, the most rot-gut sort of inner-city or underclass schools are not likely to be targeted because recruiters need prospects who can score highly on the Armed Services Vocational Battery Test. They need students who have not dropped out of high school who don't have any moral convictions or problems with the law. And so I think that's another reason why rural areas and lower middle class as opposed to lower class gets extra attention.
Cindy Williams, class or race, which has got the heavier weight here?
They both weigh. I think the reason things weigh does have to do with class. But when you finally get down to the numbers, blacks are overrepresented in the military. Blacks make up about 22% of the active duty enlisted force, where they make up about 13% of the
general
population. Hispanics are underrepresented. They make up about 10% of the military compared with 14% of the population. That's going to change somewhat in the future because black recruiting is down relative to white recruiting in the past few years. And so the black recruiting class is not as far out of line, is not as overrepresented.
So the trend line is moving.
As the overall military. Mm. That's right.
Cindy Williams, Charlie Seifert, Captain Zielinski, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to begin to invite them in. Susan is calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Good to have you. What's on your mind, Susan?
Well, this is a very interesting discussion. My daughter graduated from Cary High School 2 years ago. She was in the Naval ROTC program for 4 years. Mm-hmm. She graduated as the operations officer.
She graduated high school as a naval operations officer.
That's correct.
Got it.
In ROTC program. Mm-hmm. She was offered a full scholarship at North Carolina State University.
Yeah.
And the really interesting thing that I observed in this program is that the diversity was immense. There was Cary High School has kids who are, I guess you would call, upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Middle class, lower middle class, and then a really large variety of immigrant population. And the ROTC program there really exemplified the mix of kids in that program.
So in your experience, you saw a pretty diverse recruitment or intake by the military through the program your daughter was associated
Absolutely.
with.
And the other thing is that although my daughter did not accept the military scholarship that she was offered, most of her peers who graduated with her did accept scholarship.
Susan, when you say she didn't accept it, does that mean she did not ultimately join the Navy or something else?
No, she did not.
Okay.
She decided that she did not want to go into the military at this point in time. She is a language major, and she really wanted to do the language sort of behind the scenes in the Navy.
As a mother, Susan, let me ask you, how did you feel about the whole process? Were you glad she was in the Naval ROTC in high school all 4 years, or did it make you nervous, or what?
I was very proud of her.
Mm-hmm.
It very much provided her with an environment and a group of kids that cared about each other, that had a common goal, that really worked toward a common goal. The fellow who was part of the program, who was the head of the program actually, was absolutely wonderful. He was a Marine who had served four duties in Vietnam, and he just absolutely loved these kids and promoted these kids and tried to work very hard for them.
So it sounds like it was a good experience for your daughter, even though she decided, at least for now, not to join the military. Susan, thanks so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Cindy Williams, what do you make of this story? Here's a mother who says, well, in my neighborhood, in my daughter's high school, real cross-section.
My guess is that goes to the credit of the principal of the high school and the particular military unit that's running their junior ROTC program. I'm not positive whether Susan was talking about a high school ROTC program or the ROTC program that would take people through college.
She said 4 years in high school. I don't know which that suggests.
Yes. My guess is that she's talking about the junior ROTC mm-hmm, program, mm-hmm. which, you know, the military uses as a recruiting tool. We heard that in the first segment. But it's a very important recruiting tool because it gives military people, military recruiters, an opportunity to see which students shine and gravitate toward the military, but it also gives the students an opportunity to see whether they would like it. And it is a possibility for recruiting more elite students.
A kind of taste of things right there. I want to turn right now to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We're joined there by a guidance counselor or guidance director at St. Francis High School in St. Francis, Wisconsin, Carla Harried. Carla, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So there you are. It's your job to be a guidance counselor, director, I guess, of guidance counselors there. Tell us a bit about your school, its size, and how often you have military recruiters visiting.
Well, we have about 568 students in grades 9 through 12, and I work with all of those students. And we have usually about one time per week there is some type of military recruitment.
And how many students, on average, enlist per year out of your high school into the military?
Last year, we had about 5% enlist.
5%. So, that's a pretty tall number. Out of 568 kids, you're talking about 25 or 30 enlistees.
I'm sorry, about 5% of the senior class.
Oh, of the senior
class was about 102 students.
Okay, okay. So it's still a pretty good strong ratio for the military there. What about your own relationship with the military? Do they come to you as a guidance counselor and look to work through you to find the teenagers who might be right for the military?
The military are really quite kind to us in the guidance department as well. They don't pressure us as far as recruiting students. They give us information just as any college representative would. They give us business cards and handouts that we can supply to students.
I understand they also recently gave you a chance to see for yourself what the students might go through in basic training. As I get it, the military flew you out to San Diego, the Marine Corps facility there, to observe the camp?
They did, yes. I went to Camp Pendleton last February and had the opportunity to just observe a lot of different aspects of the Marine Corps base there.
And how did you come back feeling about military career or experience for your graduates?
That opportunity was very inspiring. It was so much of an eye-opener for me because I hadn't ever seen that side of the military. I had heard stories. I have relatives who have been in the military. I have friends who have been in the military but have never heard stories of what I've seen.
Do you counsel students to go to the military because you think they might need it or because you think it's a patriotic thing for them to do? Who do you advise to go in?
Really, I don't advise per se. I end up talking with each of the students individually, both during their junior and their senior years of high school. And I primarily ask them what they feel like doing in the future and how I can encourage them and support them by getting there to achieve their goals.
And it sounds like you're finding a fair number who are standing up and ready to do it. Carla Harried at St. Francis High School in St. Francis, Wisconsin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Carla Harried is director of the guidance department there. Charlie Savage, Cindy Williams, Captain Todd Zwolenski, please stand by. We're talking tonight about who's fighting the war and how America recruits its troops. You can join the conversation. When a democracy goes to war, should its citizen soldiers be drawn from a real cross-section of the population? Is that what you're hearing tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about who's fighting the war and how America recruits its troops. My guest tonight from MIT, Cindy Williams, from the Boston Globe, Charlie Savage, and from Kansas City, Missouri, Todd Zwolenski, captain in the Army and company commander for recruiting in Greater Kansas City. You can join the conversation tonight. Are U.S. military recruiters exploiting kids who don't have great options or giving them options they wouldn't otherwise have? When the recruitment letter comes for your teenage son or daughter, do you put it on their dresser or slip it away? And is there a moral issue in America's recruitment strategy? Is there a fairness issue or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Kevin's calling from Boston. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing, Tom?
Great. Thanks, Kevin.
Great program tonight. I actually had a situation. By the way, I'm grateful for the military. It provided me many opportunities, but I think the point that always has left a bad taste in my mouth was how it was, I felt like I was deceived in in some ways.
Deceived at what age and what circumstance,
well,
Kevin?
I was a junior, senior in high school, and what I found was my father had just become disabled. A bunch of things had happened, and we were from a middle class family. And what happened was I was pretty much told by the recruiter, you know, you're young and impressionable, that you have no other option but the military.
Hmm.
And ironically, I was on the Honor Society. I was a very good student, athlete, what have you. And I'm from Midwest, rural, same thing what you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The demographics all white, pretty much. And what happened was I ended up getting six people from my own class to go with me.
Wow, so you were a real payoff for the recruiter.
Right, and, you know, the graduating class, I only had maybe 37 people, so...
Did it end up feeling like it was a good decision? How did you end up feeling when you were older and wiser? How did you end up feeling about how you were treated or recruited?
The recruiting, I do feel like it was deceptive and that I was used to get these other people, and that now that I look back at those people who were recruited, they were good students. They did have other options, but when you're in a small rural area like that... that is used to the recruiter's advantage.
Because you may not understand those other options, but they're right there in front of you offering something.
Yes.
Kevin, we've got it, and we thank you for your story. Thanks a lot for calling in. I want to turn now to Evanston, Illinois. Charlie Moskos joins us. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Northwestern University, author of All That We Can Be, Black Leadership and Racial Integration, The Army Way, and The Military, More Than Just a Job. Charlie Moskos, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Charlie, as you look out on what's going on with the U.S. military undertakings around the world right now, the requirements of the military, very large. We see the numbers in Iraq heading up to 150,000, the largest since the war began. And the way that military has to recruit to fill the ranks, is there a fairness issue here?
There is a fairness issue, definitely. And the problems of recruitment are going to get much more severe in the near future. Let me just also preface my remarks, Tom, by saying I served as a draftee in the Cold War Army. My contemporary was Elvis Presley. That's the difference. Could you imagine Eminem in today's military?
No.
No. But the moral issue you raise, I think Charlie Rango is basically on the right track here. It's not, of course, only a race issue. It's a class issue. It's, I think, noteworthy that the two most notable names to come out of the Iraq War are Jessica Lynch and Lindy England, both white, working-class young women from Appalachia. You're not finding the Ivy League. You're not finding people from selective universities serving.
There are examples of that.
No, very. By the way, we just had news today, of course, in Chicago, where Patrick Daly, the son of Mayor Daly, just joined the military.
Wow.
But the point here is that at the ROTC level we're talking earlier, those are officers, virtually all of whom are college graduates. But when we're focusing on the enlisted ranks, that's where I think the moral issue becomes very salient. Our privileged youth are not fighting. Out of the United States Congress and Senate with 535 members, only six, you know, have children on active duty. And I think it would probably be the same for the Fortune 400.
And yet at this point, Charlie Moskos, I can't say that I see real kickback against this widely in the United States. The country seems generally to be accepting the way the volunteer military is working.
The volunteer military, you know, when it's smaller and doing peacekeeping, will work very well. But in a prolonged war, even though the casualties so far have not, you know, approached anything like Vietnam or Korea, it's not going to take it forever. You know, the point was raised too earlier that, as you just said, does it have any political consequences? What do you make out of the fact that in the last four presidential elections, the American public has chosen the draft dodger over the server?
Essentially. Well, I'll just let that
one. It's a political plus not to have served.
As a former draftee, you're entitled to ask. I'll let the people just think about that one. I want to get a response here from Captain Zwolinski in Kansas City. Todd Zwolinski, you heard there first from our caller, Kevin, who said he felt kind of hoodwinked, ultimately, in the way he was recruited out of his rural Midwestern teenage years. And then Charlie Moskos saying that there's a fairness issue in the way America's gone to war. Not many or any congressional children over there, Mayor Daley's son going, but that seems to be the exception. You're a recruiter. You see this, you know, right in front of you all the time. How do you feel about it? Do you see a fairness issue?
Well, I do see a fairness issue. One thing that's notable is in 1982, There were 19.2% of CAT 4 recruits. A CAT 4 is someone who scores lower than 30 on the ASVAB, basically a solid C student or lower.
Okay.
And that dropped down to 0.4% in 1992.
So you're not taking nearly as many of those low grade average students.
Exactly. And I think that's a big issue also.
How does it fit into the fairness conversation?
Well, because we're leaving a certain segment of the population, like the first gentleman mentioned, how the urban areas are basically being left out of the recruiting picture. Our percentage of African Americans that we're assessing into the military has dropped.
It was higher than the national average, but now that's fallen, as Cindy Williams was saying.
Exactly. It's going down. So there's a certain segment that isn't even allowed to come into the military because of their educational background, their moral background. If you have a felony, or even if you have a certain combination of misdemeanors or other violations, law violations, you can't come in.
So you're slicing this in an even more knowing way. You're saying it's not just elites who aren't coming in. It's actually kind of elites and the bottom socioeconomic tier.
Exactly. And that concerns me because we have, both from a numbers standpoint, 40% of the people that come talk to us are not qualified to join the United States military and any of the services. The Army happens to have the lowest standards because it is the largest service. So it's there's two pieces that are being left out of the puzzle. As a percentage of the population, when you figure how many people are actually in the military, it's not surprising that there's only six sons and daughters of legislators in the military, because the military does not comprise that large of a population,
right?
Only 280 million of us.
Right. But then when we look at the percentages coming in from the high schools we've been hearing about tonight, we've got some quite different outcomes there. I want to get another call here. Lana's calling from Platteville, Wisconsin. Hi, Lana. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for
sure.
taking my call.
Yeah.
Your show is reinforcing an idea that I've always had, that a war is a rich man's war and a poor man's fight, in that we see the lower socioeconomic being targeted.
Do you see that directly in your experience, Lana?
Well, yes. We live in a rural community in Wisconsin. My son was one of the 15% that enlisted after 9/11. You know, he just felt a duty.
Out of his high school class, you're saying?
Right, right. And my husband is a retired Army Reserve, and we have lived in military communities. He was familiar with that lifestyle.
And do you feel, how do you feel about the fact that your son did he just volunteer or was he recruited?
He was actively recruited.
Right. How do you feel about it now that he's in, Lana?
Well, I'm not very happy because I feel like he has an irresponsible commander-in-chief, and so it's pretty frightening. I would like to add that the September 2004 issue of VFW Magazine had a brief article titled America at War, but Not Americans. And in that, it indicated that less than 1% of our total population is serving in the military.
An indication that there's some conversation about this inside the active military, maybe.
Yeah. And it concerns me that we don't have a broader section, cross-section of economic or the classes serving in the military.
Why exactly, Lana? Why does that bother you exactly?
Well, because it's the privileged primarily that serve in our government. Our president being a perfect case in point.
Okay, and so if they were serving more, what?
Well, I personally think that if more people had been touched by this war, if they had people or family members serving and in harm's way, I personally don't think President Bush would have been reelected, because if more people are touched by a war, if they have firsthand contact with it, they're more aware of what's going on in the military. They're more aware of what's going on politically.
Spoken by a mother whose son is at war. Lana, thanks very much for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Charlie Savage, I wonder if you got a chance in your reporting to speak to any of the parents of the high schools where you were poking around.
I was kept for various privacy reasons from interacting with the students directly, and so I did not speak to parents.
Because here we're hearing a mother in Wisconsin saying, you know, I wish that this burden was shared more widely, but within the kind of hothouse of the school, that doesn't seem to be the attitude that you found.
True. Well, within schools that are these high-target schools, I'm reminded of the earlier caller who was the guidance counselor who in the military had, I guess, flown out to California to show her the benefits of joining on a special trip.
I mean, out to Camp Pendleton. That's quite a trip for a guidance counselor.
Indeed. These schools, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with this. I mean, it's just sort of a phenomenon to observe.
Mm-hmm.
That those schools, it's very likely that the officials who lead the school think that the military is a good idea themselves. They probably do have some military background themselves. The guidance counselor at McDonough High that I talked to, her own son had been in the Air Force for 4 years, and she noted to me as an aside that he never left the country during those 4 years, and then he had just gotten out, and that made her – she wasn't unhappy about that. So there was that sort of parental, my own kid, encroaching on what is otherwise a gung-ho for the service. Nevertheless, these are – you know, the opinion makers and the student leaders in those schools – probably agree that the military is a really good idea, at least for people who don't have other options.
So they're very supportive right there. Charlie Moskos, how do you see this playing out longer term? Is the country so accustomed now to a volunteer military and the kind of cross-section or the kind of, I should say, slice of the population that draws, that it's just accepted, that everyone's going to go along and this is just the way it will be?
I think you're going to see basically an acceptance because people will want somebody else's son or daughter to serve rather than their own. What you'll see, though, in the near future will be something like lowering standards for entering the military, where today virtually every recruit has to have a high school diploma. That will probably be dropped. You'll see higher entry pay and enlistment bonuses made. You'll see much more civilian contracting going on, which is already a big thing. And you'll probably also find more foreigners, non-Americans, being recruited.
You mean not American-born immigrants, in other words? Or?
Immigrants are, and we may even go further, like the Brits and higher Gurkha types. But it's going to be anything to avoid getting the upper middle class into the service. And that's what I think will sort of limp through. The other variable, too, which has to be mentioned, is that two-thirds of our high school graduates today go on directly to some form of higher education. And about 1.2 million out of a cohort of about 3.5 actually get a bachelor's degree in 4 or 5 years after they've entered college. The military is recruiting just a minuscule number of college graduates. Another option, which I've been proposing since I know the draft is not coming back, even though I support her, is to think of a short-term enlistment option.
Kind of a quick tour of duty.
15 months, for example.
15 months. Charlie, I've got to turn to Cindy Williams just for a moment here. Cindy, we've only got half a minute left, and I'm sorry for that. But how do you see this playing out? Is the system sustainable as it's currently working, or are there political or statistical problems with filling the ranks with this system, these targets?
No, I think the system is sustainable, and I think probably the most important point that was made about this is the one that Lana made about the military today needing so few people relative to the size of the population. And once you know that you're going to have a military that's relatively small in comparison to the size of the population, it tells you a lot about whether a draft is sustainable. If you only need 10% of the male young people every year as they turn 18 or 19 years old, that means that if you restore a draft, it's always going to be unfair to somebody.
Right. You're just going to be picking a small slice all the time, and so it goes
on. From one thing to a game of chance.
Cindy, with that, we're out of time. Cindy Williams of MIT, thank you so much for being with us. Charlie Savage with the Boston Globe, terrific reporting, terrific piece.
Thank you.
Captain Todd Zwolenski in Kansas City, Missouri. Wonderful of you to join us tonight, and good luck to you there, Captain.
Thank you, sir.
And Charlie Moskos, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Northwestern University, thanks for joining us.
Welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.